Hey everyone, welcome to the Steve Hilton Show. It's Wednesday the 18th of October. We've got a busy show for you today. We're going to start with the big story, of course, which is the despicable terrorist attack on Israel and the aftermath. Lot to say about that. In particular, what it tells us about the ideology that has infected the left, the Democrats these days, and the consequences of that, not just playing out right now in Israel and Gaza, but right here at home on issues like crime and the border. We'll get into that. Janet Yellen, you may have seen, has been out saying that it's fine. We can afford multiple wars at the same time, and it's no problem at all. We can afford to be at war. Can we really? Let's find out. We'll discuss that. California Corner today. Susan Shelley is with us. There's always something terrible going on in California, and Susan's going to give us the latest. And then finally, I've got something to say about the chaos that we're seeing in the House of Representatives. It's changing by the minute, but I'm going to stop the clock and tell you what I think about what's going on and what needs to happen next. Obviously, the despicable butchery and slaughter that has been happening in the Holy Land, and the reactions and all the commentary that has ensued, the scenes of utter depravity on our campuses where you have people justifying this murder, absolutely sickening. But there's one aspect of it that I want to focus on today, and that is the role of Iran and the role of our government in enabling this attack to happen through its Iran policy, and what that tells us about an ideology that is pervasive now among the Democrats and on the left, that is really causing a lot of problems, not just in relation to this particular crisis, but also throughout domestic policy as well. And that's what I'm going to lay out for you today. And let's start with an article that I think was so shocking. I mean, there's a lot to have been shocked about these last few days, but this one in particular, I'm not sure, it hasn't been widely shared. So let's get to the headline of this article. And then what it says about what's been going on. It is absolutely stunning. Here's the headline. It's in Tablet magazine, right? Online Tablet. The Biden administration tries to hide what it knew about an impending massacre while leaving US backing for Iran untouched. That's the headline. And it talks about the background to the most detailed reporting we've seen about the fact that Iran planned this whole thing in detail. You saw it first in the Wall Street Journal days after the attack, and then in the New York Times as well. And they lay out in specific detail that it was the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard International Division that went to Lebanon to sit down in coordination meetings with Hamas and the other terror groups that they support, specifically to plan this attack and, of course, fund it with the money that they had through the lifting of the sanctions that the Biden administration did. So that's very detailed reporting about Iran's role. But yet, the Biden administration still refuses to accept that there's any evidence. They keep saying there's no evidence of Iran's role. No evidence. And they will not hold Iran accountable. And here's what here's why. I'm going to read to you from this article. Sources for the Times piece, the New York Times piece that laid out Iran's role, claimed that for over a year, Iran helped plan the Hamas attack in coordination with Hezbollah, using Lebanon and Syria as training grounds. The Times piece corroborated an October the 8th Wall Street Journal article, that's the one I just mentioned, reporting that Iran had planned the invasion and green-lighted it the Monday before. But listen to this. Reporters at the Wall Street Journal's Washington, D.C. bureau, who had no access to the journal's foreign sources, were dead set against their own Middle East-based colleagues publishing that piece based on their reporting that made Iran's role clear. Why? Because their interest, I'm quoting now, was in protecting their official sources in Washington, who continued to deny any Iranian role in the attack. And the piece goes on. That's what concerns the White House. Not the prospect of a war with a terror state the United States has lavishly funded, but the PR mess that will ensue as it becomes clear, as it already has from the Journal and the Times reports, what exactly Washington withheld from Jerusalem about what the Americans knew about the coming attack and Iran's role in sponsoring, planning, and approving it. So that explains what's been going on here. The reason the administration is not holding Iran forcefully accountable is because they're embarrassed. They're embarrassed about what it shows about their own policy of appeasement towards Iran that's been going on ever since they took office. You saw it with the desperate efforts to get back into the Iran nuclear deal, lifting the sanctions on Iran, on their oil, so they can enrich themselves. Many billions of dollars more money coming into the Iranian coffers that they could send to Hamas's coffers because of the policies of the Biden administration. Of course, it's true that the people responsible for the attack are the monsters who did it, the criminals. The butchery and slaughter is the responsibility of the individual people who did it and those who planned it and ordered it. That's true. It's not Biden's responsibility in that sense, not directly. But they contributed to a world in which this was possible. They helped fund it because of the money that went to Iran. And now they're embarrassed about it and they're running away from it. And it's not just Iran, by the way. People talk about that. They talk about the $6 billion. That's been widely discussed the last week. Less widely discussed is the fact that the Biden administration also lifted sanctions, not just on Iran, but directly on Hamas. They lifted sanctions on Hamas that the Trump administration put in place precisely because the so-called humanitarian or social welfare assistance that we had been sending through our aid agency, USAID, to Hamas, the Trump administration judged that this would end up funding terrorism. So they put sanctions on it. Well, guess what? The Biden administration lifted the sanctions on Hamas. And even as they did that, the actual letter that they sent in the bureaucratic process in Washington, the State Department sent a letter to the Treasury Department requesting the lifting of the sanctions. In their own letter, they say that some of this money, there's a risk, that's the word, there's a risk that some of this money could end up funding terrorism. But they did it anyway. They did it anyway. And what does this show you? It shows you that the left, the Democrats, have been infected with an ideology of appeasement. That's what's going on here. And it has a much wider impact than just this situation in the Middle East. Of course, it's clear that they appeased Iran, trying to get them in the nuclear deal, trying to help them sell oil because they thought that would bring them to the table. The operating theory that they have now, the Democrats, the left generally, is if you are nice to bad people, then they'll be good. They tried it with Putin. That's what we saw with Putin, didn't we? With the lifting of the sanctions. Immediately, they got in. They lifted the sanctions that were there on the Nord Stream pipeline. Appeasement. Afghanistan, that kicked it all off. Appeasement again. On and on. They have this ideology of appeasement. And it has made the world more dangerous and unstable than we've seen in decades. I mean, this great genius of foreign policy, Joe Biden. What a disaster he's been. The application of this ideology of appeasement to foreign policy has been a complete catastrophe. It has destroyed lives and made the world more dangerous than it's been in many people's living memory. But it's not just on foreign policy. That's what's really important to understand. And I don't see people talking about that this week, but we should talk about it because this goes deeper than just foreign policy and Iran and Israel and Putin and Ukraine and all the rest of it. We see it here at home as well, this ideology of appeasement, this theory that if you're nice to bad people, they'll be good. We see it at the border. Well, if we're just nice and compassionate, everything will be fine. Look at the consequences of that. The absolute chaos and inhumanity that we're seeing, the crime, the fentanyl, all the rest of it. That it comes from the same place, this ideology of appeasement. And of course, we see it on our streets with crime. That ideology of appeasement has infected the Democrats and the left when it comes to tackling crime. They don't want to tackle crime because it's the same thought process. If you are nice to bad people, they'll be good. So if you're nice to criminals, they won't commit crime. Well, how's that working out? How's that working out on the streets of New York or Los Angeles or Chicago, where you have these far left district attorneys putting into practice this ideology of appeasement, decriminalizing crime effectively? You see it here in California, you see it across the country. It has been a complete disaster. And so we have to understand that all these things that are going wrong here at home and around the world, so many of them come from a thought process, an ideology of appeasement that has been a complete disaster. It's been a disaster in history. We saw it with Hitler in the 1930s, when the British tried to appease Hitler. How did that work out? A disaster for Europe and the world. And we're seeing it play out again. Appeasement is always wrong. It is always a disaster. If you are nice to bad people, they don't become good. They become even worse. And they think they've got a green light to go ahead and commit their atrocities. Whether that atrocity is what we saw in southern Israel from Hamas, or whether it's at our southern border, or whether it's on our doorstep with the criminals that are making life a misery for communities up and down the country. We have to be clear about what's going on here. The ideology of appeasement. We've got to stand up to it, we've got to fight it, and we've got to defeat it. All right, let's get to our policy story this week, which is connected to what's going on with Israel and Gaza. But it's a broader point. It's an economic point. And I got thinking about it when I heard this from our esteemed Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, when asked whether we could afford to pay for yet another war. Listen to what she said.
With debt to GDP at 122%, can America, can the West afford another war at this time?
I think the answer is absolutely. America can certainly afford to stand with Israel and to support Israel's military needs. And we also can and must support Ukraine in its struggle against Russia. And look, the American economy is doing extremely well. Inflation has been high and it's been a concern to households. It's come down considerably. At the same time, we have about the strongest labor market we've seen in 50 years with 3.8% unemployment. And at the same time, America, the Biden administration, has passed legislation that is strengthening our economy in the years to come for the medium term.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there. Let's just go in reverse order. So she's saying that they're introducing policies to strengthen our economy in the long term. Well, that is completely ridiculous. Pretty much everything they're doing is actually weakening our economy. The crazy extremist climate policy is undermining our ability to fuel and power our economy. Look, we all, you know, can support a responsible energy transition. That is exactly the opposite of what they're doing. They're making us more reliant on less reliable energy, sacrificing our ability to earn money from our energy resources around the world. Is an absolute disaster and affects every industry. That's weakening it. Then this industrial policy that they're doing, like taking massive amounts of taxpayer money and throwing it at favored industries and companies, is just a total disaster. It's never worked in the past. And it's not going to work this time. It's actually weakening the competitive strength of the US economy and our capacity for innovation. When you have the government deciding where investment goes, it doesn't go to the most productive places. It goes to the places that bureaucrats think it should go to. That is a disaster. It's the exact opposite of what has led to America's economic strength, especially in the 20th century. She says the economy is doing very well. Oh, is it? Well, The verdict of the voters is exactly the opposite, and they keep scratching their heads. People like Janet Yellen and others saying, well, what's going on? You know, why aren't people agreeing with us that the economy is doing very well? Because it isn't. It isn't doing very well because you have the calamity of this massive spending that unleashed the inflation. That means that you've actually seen real terms, household incomes, the actual amount that you get relative to what things cost in the economy, fall by around $4,000 is the median. Right? The typical family is $4,000 a year worse off. So no wonder they don't agree that the economy is doing very well. But the big point I want to get to is where we started. So the question there was, can we afford another war? And she says, absolutely. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Bring it on. Let's have another one. Let's have 10 more wars. We can afford it. Well, the only way they can afford it is by printing more money, which is what's been going on. As the questioner said, we have a massive debt that's piling up year after year with these huge deficits. And it's just going to get worse because nobody's actually thinking about the policies that would restrain that. And here's a headline just from a couple of months ago from Reuters reporting the Congressional Budget Office's projections for the debt. It's just going to get massively worse. Here's the headline, U.S. public debt burden to rise to 181% of GDP by 2053. I mean, that's a total disaster. You can't run an economy on that basis. Why? Because the debt payments are just so huge. Already, they're approaching and soon to be higher than what we spend on our defense. The amount of money that we spend paying interest on the debt is more than we're spending on national defense. You can't carry on that basis. I mean, we're going to hit that point soon. It's just absolutely reckless and irresponsible to say we can just sort of open the floodgates and spend whatever we want on anything we want. No, look, I'm all for making sure that defense spending is high. We need more defense spending. That's true, because they've undermined our military and our readiness and our ability to defend America against threats all around the world, including China. But something's got to give in order to make that happen. So where are the reductions in spending? Where's the elimination of programs that's going to accommodate this spending? It is completely ridiculous, and it captures the sort of totally irresponsible attitude of these politicians, which is like, well, we'll just sort of do it for the couple of years that we're here, and you know, please everyone by spending money and throwing money around, and who cares about the future? And this is the real point, and it just reminds me of something I saw just recently. I went to a really fantastic event here in California where I live, just the last weekend, with Neil Ferguson, who's a brilliant historian. He's a friend of mine. He's absolutely fantastic. You may have seen him on my shows over the years. And he was talking about his book, The Great Degeneration. And he's talking about the four big things that are going wrong. And debt is absolutely the heart of it. And he made the point that debt is not just some abstract thing that's just kind of financially, you know, financial relevant just to financial markets and so on. It is a real betrayal of future generations, because what we're actually doing is saying, We're going to spend whatever we want, and we're going to ask our children and their generation to pick up the tab. And it is exactly the opposite of what conservatism certainly should all be about, which is, as he cited the great conservative writer Edmund Burke, that conservatism is a contract between the current generation, the past generation, and the next generation. And you've got to be responsible, and we're the exact opposite of responsible. So when you have Janet Yellen blithely saying, yeah, whatever, we'll pay for another war, it is exactly the opposite of what we need, and an example of how irresponsible this administration has been. All right, joining us today for California Corner is Susan Shelley with a story that we've touched on before. It's incredibly important because it's something that just hasn't been discussed enough, which was a massive stealth tax increase that happened just recently. And Susan and her team at Howard Jarvis are trying to overturn it, fighting a very valiant fight, and it's going well. The sort of headline is Repeal the Death Tax, Susan. Tell us the background and the latest news.
Well, the background is that people, after Prop 13 passed in the 1970s, when people inherited property, it counted as a change of ownership and it was reassessed to market value. People were very upset because they couldn't pay those new higher tax bills on homes and other property they just inherited from their parents. So the legislature put something on the ballot by a unanimous vote to fix that and create a parent-child exception from reassessment. And that has now been taken away. It was passed in 1986 on the ballot with 75% of the vote after a unanimous vote of the legislature, mm-hmm. and then it was quietly removed in Proposition 19 in 2020, which looked like it was about helping wildfire victims and helping seniors move to a new home, and it was, and it did, and that's fine, and nobody's changing that. But hidden inside was the biggest property tax increase in the history of California. And that's what we're going after. We want to repeal that. And it's a death tax because it hits people when they lose a parent and they inherit family property. So although it's not an estate tax per se, it's a little worse because property taxes you have to pay every year as a condition of keeping what you already own. And the way real estate has appreciated in California, to pay the taxes on the new market value of long-held family property is crushing people. And it affects tenants as well, because when a mom-and-pop apartment building passes to the next generation and is reassessed at current value, the rents will have to go up or the building will have to be sold because people can't make that work. So this is a devastating thing that's happened. And no one knew that this was going to affect Californians this way. No one knew that was in Prop 19. So we think voters deserve a chance to vote on it again in the daylight, seeing exactly what's going on here, and put back the old rules. So that's what we're doing. We want to put back the old rules as they existed, which means a home of any value could be inherited without a change to the tax bill, and up to $1 million of taxable value, assessed value of other property. So that's a small business, an apartment building, even a vacation cabin. It can be passed to the kids without any change to the tax bill. Extremely important. and retroactive so that people who got burned can get their old tax assessment back.
Amazing. So just right there. First of all, thank you for explaining it so clearly. You are absolutely brilliant. And the other thing it just reminds us of before we get into the detail of what's happening with this and how people can support it, it just reminds us what an incredibly important organization Howard Jarvis is. Because, I mean, who else is keeping an eye on this stuff? And not just, you know, raising the red flag when you have something like this, this incredibly sneaky tax increase that's basically they tried to hide, but then trying to do something about it, actually getting there and fighting for taxpayers. I mean, it's a brilliant organization that you're part
yes,
of.
Yes, and it's a member-supported organization. Obviously, it doesn't get any government money. So
no, they hate you.
They hate us. So if you want to join, just go to hjta.org and click join us and be a member and strengthen the voice of taxpayers in California.
All right. So tell us the latest on how it's going, because you qualified
it. It's going very well.
You got your title and summary. This is, I'm very much enmeshed in this process because, of course, we have our own ballot initiative that my organization, Golden Together, is promoting to try and make home ownership affordable in California again, to restore the California dream of home ownership. So I know about all this process very intimately, but you've had that first stage where the mm-hmm. Attorney General has given you the title and summary for your initiative. So you can now go, you are now going out and gathering signatures.
Yes, we are. We're gathering signatures, and it's very easy because we made this fit on a one-page petition. So it fits on one letter-sized sheet of paper, and you can download a legally valid petition at home and print it and sign it and mail it to us, and it will count. You fill it out correctly. The instructions are all included. You just go to repealthedeathtax.com. Repealthedeathtax.com is the link. You click the download the petition button, and you will get a PDF that has the petition, the instructions, a flyer, even a mailing label to send it back to Howard Jarvis. Very easy to do.
Brilliant. So what's been happening in terms of the coalition you're building for this?
Well, it's going very well. The California Republican Party formally endorsed this measure at its fall convention, which is an unusual step for them because usually they wait until something has qualified for the ballot, but they jumped in early on this. Mm-hmm. So we're grateful to have the support of the California Republican Party and all their central committees and hopefully all their elected officials to help push this information out, that people can go to repealthedeathtax.com and download the petition right now. And we need a million signatures, so that's helpful. And other people who have jumped on board, the Rebuild California organization, which did the Gavin Newsom recall, qualified that for the ballot. They are behind this, and they are helping very strongly to qualify this, sending information to their members and talking about it on their radio programs. And also in San Diego, Carl DeMaio's organization, Reform California, which has an enormous mailing list, a lot of supporters, they are 100% behind this as well. And the same thing, promoting it to their members and doing it on his radio show. And we're all working really hard. And Howard Jarvis has mailed it out to all the members of this organization, and those are coming back in giant boxes. So the response has been very strong. People really don't like this tax increase on family yeah. property.
It's so interesting. This tax issue is just not discussed enough because in California, a lot of the issues that dominate the political conversation, and a lot of it is engineered by the Democrats, you know, to sort of keep people's eye off the ball of what's really going on. So, you know, these high profile arguments about, you know, what's going on in schools and trans kids, and they pick these fights and you know, you try and use it for their political advantage. But the underlying fact is that on these basics of, you know, daily life, we're just in a increasingly precarious position in California. We have the worst business climate in the country, 50th out mm-hmm. of 50, the highest taxes in the country, top of the list. As I always say, we're top of every list you want to be bottom of, and bottom of every list you want to be top of. And it's really true.
Yes.
It's not an exaggeration. We're the worst business climate, not like 42nd out of 50, the worst. We're the highest taxes, not like fourth highest, the highest. And it's just really, you know, these fundamentals are just all going in the wrong direction, and we have to fight back.
And this is a situation where people have worked for 30 years paying mortgages to own property, to leave something to their kids. And in every community, it's important to build generational wealth. This
exactly.
is not something just for gazillionaires. This is for regular people who buy property, who keep it up, who pay the taxes year after year, who pay off those mortgages and want to leave that property to their kids, perhaps to rent, perhaps to live in, perhaps to sell and invest the money, up to the kids, up to the family. But if it's all taken away with tax increases, then that's devastating. Exactly. And these are huge tax increases. You can talk about quintupling the taxes for a home that's, or a business property that's been owned for a long time. And it's an enormous hit and people can't pay it.
Exactly. And it's so interesting, actually, this conversation, because in a way, what we're working on with my initiative, the it's called the California Home Ownership Affordability Act. We're a little bit behind you. We haven't got the title and summary yet. But that's, in a way, it's working on the generational wealth point from the other end of the pipeline, which is enabling people to get on the housing ladder in the first place by buying a home. That's totally out of reach. I think a recent survey showed that only 16% of Californians could afford the typical home in California at all. And one of the reasons is taxes. And that's one of the targets of our initiative. They call it impact fees, which is actually a tax on house building or apartment construction. It's paid by the developer or the house builder. It's passed on to the consumer. And these are enormous numbers, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. In San Francisco, $300,000 per apartment unit, not the building. This is just a straight up tax. And it's so interesting, the conversations we've been having from, you know, and we're talking to everyone about it. And one thing you hear, I've heard a few times now as well, if you cap the impact fees, which is what our ballot initiative does, then you know that you're starving local government of funds and there's no money. And you think, hang on a second, we're the highest tax state in the union. It's not as if they don't have enough of our tax money.
Exactly. And housing is very important. But what do they want to do? They want to raise taxes to build government housing and then decide who gets to live in it with this series of qualifiers and restrictions and whatever. That's not the answer. If you go back to post-World War II America, there was a severe housing shortage, when those troops came home and all those new households were being formed. And people were sleeping in tents in parks. Veterans were sleeping in tents in parks. They did not raise taxes on housing development. They helped people buy houses. They expedited the building of new communities. It even became kind of a joke that there were like ticky-tack houses that all looked the same in post-war America. But they were building houses that people could afford, and they were helping people afford them with loans. And that's what we need to do.
Exactly.
We don't need apartment buildings on top of train tracks that are luxury prices with two affordable units in the basement. That we don't need. That's not the answer.
Exactly. And we'll leave it here. But if you especially if you look at California, I mean, the kind of left is all about, well, exactly what you just said, you know, the sort of North Korea style approach to housing, the citizenry, you know, raise your kids on in a part with the sort of, you know, a balcony. No, it's the California dream. It's a house with a yard and the kids can play and enjoy the weather. And we have plenty of space to do that. And my favorite stat, in a way, because it's so, you know, people just don't think about it, is when they go on about housing density, right? We have the highest housing density in the whole country. It's around 5 to 6% of our land is used for any kind of development at all. If you add it all up, housing, retail, offices, you know, infrastructure, everything, roads, it comes to around 5% of our land. So the idea that we can't build more lovely houses so people can enjoy the California dream is ridiculous. And that's what we are fighting against. And you're fighting to make sure that if you get on the housing ladder, you can keep that wealth in the family. It's all good. And we're very happy to see you today, Susan, to explain all that. And finally, just tell people where they can go to get involved and support your campaign.
Go to repealthedeathtax.com and click the button to download the petition. And it's all self-explanatory, very easy. Repealthedeathtax.com.
Fantastic. Thank you, Susan. We'll see you soon.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, so here's what I want to get off my chest this week. And this is a fast-moving situation, so who knows where we're going to be by the time you listen to this or watch this. But this is, as of now, Wednesday, the 18th of October, kind of roughly noon on the West Coast. Where we are is that in the race to be the next Speaker of the House, Jim Jordan has lost the second round by slightly more than the first round. And whatever, how many more rounds, who knows? But I can tell you what most normal people are thinking when they watch this. Like, what is going on? This is totally ridiculous. It is absurd. It is ridiculous. It's an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment for the Republican Party. And by the way, it makes it that much harder for Republicans anywhere to get elected. We know what a disaster Democrat rule has been here in California, across the country. We've got to win elections. And what does this do to those good, decent Republican candidates who are running around desperately trying to raise money and knock on doors and get elected and persuade their people that if you vote Republican, you're going to get good outcomes, when they say, really? Look at what's going on in Washington. You think I'll vote Republican if this is what we get? It is a disaster. Now, look, when you consider the individual arguments of, you know, like Matt Gaetz was arguing at the beginning when they got rid of Kevin McCarthy and so on. And yes, of course, we need fiscal responsibility. We just talked about that. I agree with that. Of course, we need to cut spending and so on. So when you look at the actual policy arguments going on here, you know, you can have sympathy with some of the people who are objecting to whatever it is. But we're way past that now. Who thinks this is anything to do with actual serious policy arguments? It seems like it's all just about personalities and who hates who and who likes who and who's pissed off with who because of what they did last time or what they think they're going to do now. But it's just a joke. It's an absolute joke. Please, guys, get your act together for the sake of your party and its reputation and for the sake of the country. Get it together, people. All right, hope you enjoyed that episode of The Steve Hilton Show. Make sure you join us every week. A new episode will be out every week. You can follow us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter, I mean X, I mean whatever. You know what I'm talking about. At Steve Hilton Show. Follow me at Steve Hilton X for all the news about this show and everything else I'm up to. And we will see you back here soon for the next episode of The Steve Hilton Show.